Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian Magazine here on OWL Radio. And today's articles are from the July-August 2022 edition. Smithsonian, as I've mentioned before, covers such a variety of types of articles, and we're going to hit some of those today, starting with some history, but it also could include food origins, ecology, justice issues, geography, medicine, whatever. So we have lots of variety. This first article is entitled The Real Deal, and it's written by Amy Crawford. The subtitle says, "The founding document of Liberia went missing for nearly 200 years. Then a Maryland historian began his search." This is going to throw a little geography in for us as well. In December 1821, the U.S. Navy schooner Alligator, under the command of Lieutenant Robert F. Stockton, sailed down Africa's windward coast to anchor off a rocky headland known as Cape Mesenrado. The Alligator's usual assignment was to patrol the area for American ships engaging in the transatlantic slave trade, which the United States had outlawed 13 years earlier. That's curious. So that would have been 1808. I wasn't aware of that. But on this voyage, Stockton was transporting a New Jersey physician named Eli Ayers, an agent for the American Colonization Society, which was seeking a permanent home in Africa for free black Americans. The two men spent 4 days ashore negotiating a contract with local leaders to purchase a narrow tract of land that scholars estimate covered about 140 acres. Payment would come in the form of trade goods, including guns, gunpowder, tobacco, rum, tableware, utensils, shoes, hats, umbrellas, and mirrors, together worth roughly $7,000 in today's money. Both parties also pledged to live in peace and friendship forever. Ayers recorded the deal in careful script on the front and back of a single sheet of paper. He signed it along with Stockton and six local leaders who referred to themselves as Peter, George, Zoda, Long Peter, Governor, and Jimmy. They were called kings in the contract, although they were not monarchs in the European sense. The written agreement, not unusual for the era, if astonishingly casual to the modern legalistic mind, is the founding document of the nation that would become Liberia. American newspapers published accounts of the purchase and transcripts of the contract after Ayers returned to the States. But in 1835, a committee of the American Colonization Society reported that the document itself was missing, the last time the contract was known to be cited in print. Over the ensuing decades, that loss contributed to the myth that the contract had never existed at all, that the Americans had simply seized the land by force or fraud. Not often is a historian presented with such a high-stakes challenge. Find a nearly 200-year-old sheet of paper, which may not even be real, that launched a new nation. But it was a challenge that C. Patrick Burroughs, a former Penn State University professor who has spent much of his career researching Liberia's early history, was eager to take on. So exactly two centuries after the document was supposedly drafted, Burroughs set out to solve the existential mystery and clarify our understanding of a critical chapter of U.S. and American and African history. The American Colonization Society was founded in 1816 by a group of white clergymen and political leaders who saw repatriation to Africa as a possible future for free black Americans. Among its supporters were slaveholders who feared that the increasing number of free black people living in the South might foment uprisings, and white abolitionists who believed an African homeland offered the best chance for black self-determination. For their part, black anti-slavery activists tended to be more skeptical of this scheme. Still, many of those backing the ACS simply hoped to alleviate political tensions then growing around the question of slavery, Burroughs said. They thought, if we can get a colony for free blacks, we can take the pressure off. Of course, the pressure would keep building until it exploded in the Civil War, but meanwhile, the ACS pursued its vision. In March 1820, its first ship, carrying 86 settlers, arrived in Sierra Leone, landing at swampy Sherbro Island. But the ACS was unable to persuade local residents to sign over land because the island was plagued by mosquitoes that carried malaria and other diseases. ACS officials turned to Cape Mesurado, about 150 miles to the southeast, on the advice of a Lieutenant Matthew C. Perry, of the U.S. Navy, who was posted in the area. The ACS resettled the Sherbro repatriates to Mesurado and named the area Liberia to signify that it was a home for free people. Because Ayres kept a detailed journal of the 1821 journey to Cape Mesurado, the newspapers printed the text of the agreement. We know much of what happened that December, but the absence of the original document left an enormous hole in the historical record. Burroughs knew hunting down a phantom document that no one had seen in nearly two centuries would not be easy. Having exhausted the official records of the ACS, he broadened his search to include the archives of lawyers known to have worked for the Society. Perhaps one had stowed the document away and forgotten about it. Early in his search, Burroughs looked into Francis Scott Key, better known as the lyricist behind the Star-Spangled Banner, but the hunt through Key's papers, archived in Baltimore, proved fruitless. Next was Elias Caldwell, who had clerked for the Supreme Court during the tenure of Justice Bushrod Washington, President George Washington's nephew, and an ACS co-founder. Charles Gunther, an Illinois collector, had donated some of Caldwell's papers to the Chicago History Museum, and among the drafts of Supreme Court decisions and an insurance policy for Mount Vernon were records of Caldwell's work for the ACS. It was August 2021, and pandemic precautions kept Burroughs from visiting the museum. He asked archivists to send him scans of the entire Bushrod Washington archive, hundreds of documents, each page of which he reviewed. I really was about to give up, Burroughs recalls in a phone interview from his home in Columbia, Maryland. Then he found himself gazing at a scan of a severely yellowed letter with unmistakably elegant 19th century handwriting. The Liberia Purchase Contract. That was the highest point of my professional career, he recalls. The discovery, which Burroughs presented earlier this year in a talk at the Library of Congress, has electrified historians who study slavery, abolition, and the deep ties between the United States and Liberia. One might think about it as the difference between having a transcription of the Declaration of Independence and the actual declaration, says Eric Burin, a historian at the University of North Dakota and author of a 2005 book about the ACS, Slavery and the Peculiar Solution. This is a very important document in Liberian history. Burroughs compared a high-resolution copy of the contract with known samples of Ayres' handwriting. They matched. That alone was significant, since the accepted wisdom was that Stockton penned the document. Most important, the discovery will help put to rest the claim long advanced by historians and others that no legitimate contract ever existed, an idea that has helped fuel political tensions and conflict in Liberia between indigenous groups and the descendants of formerly enslaved settlers. That particular myth arose in the mid-20th century when some American historians re-examining U.S.-African relations from a perspective critical of American colonialism suggested that Stockton and Ayers took advantage of the African leaders by forcing the deal at gunpoint, an infamous scene of pistol diplomacy, as one author put it. Others asserted that the Africans did not understand Western notions of property and could not meaningfully consent to the sale. There's an idea that they were just bought off with baubles and beads and didn't understand what was going on, Burren said. The notion was consistent with Americans' aggressive dealings with other nations, including the exploitation of Native Americans, the acquisition of Mexican territory, and the imperialist surge of the Spanish-American War. Yet the idea that U.S. operators swindled their African hosts has its own demeaning, even racist implication. It portrays the West African sellers as ignorant and unsophisticated. In fact, Burroughs argues, coastal West Africans had been dealing with white people for centuries and knew well how to make advantageous bargains. As he points out, they charged the buyers nearly twice the going rate for unimproved land in the States. The knowledge that the document is real contributes to further scholarship and interpretation, including the impact of the agreement on the local slave trade. Some local leaders had profited both from trade in goods with Europeans and from capturing and selling their neighbors into slavery. The negotiations on Cape Mesurado required them to consider whether they would continue this grim practice. The main sticking point was the slave trade, and the objections to the Americans buying land came from people who were interested in continuing it, Burroughs says. But the African leaders who signed the agreement knew that the slave trade had been abolished in England and that the U.S. had recently proscribed further imports of captive Africans. Slavery, they recognized, was on its way out. By dealing with the American settlers, Burroughs said, the locals were taking an implicitly abolitionist position. Indeed, the agreement helped bring about an eventual end to these leaders' relationships with local slave traders by about 1840, sooner than in any other slave trading region of Africa. On the other side of the Atlantic, Black Americans were faced with a fraught choice. Most, like abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass, found the prospect of emigration not only unenticing but insulting. As Douglass would later put it in an 1852 newspaper editorial, there is no sentiment more universally entertained nor more firmly held by the free colored people of the United States than that this is their own, their native land. Still, plenty of African Americans decided to seek a different destiny in Liberia. Once the first few dozen settlers left Sherbro Island for Cape Mesurado in April 1822, the colony quickly expanded, and the ACS negotiated further land transfers with local leaders. By 1838, tens of thousands of free Black American repatriates were living in the city that would become Liberia's capital, Monrovia, named after President James Monroe, who backed the ACS and had been in office at the time of the Cape Mesurado purchase. Some who made the journey were idealists of one sort or another. Take Lot Carey, or Carey, sources differ, who had purchased his freedom in Virginia around 1813 and left with the first group of colonists because he hoped to spread Christianity in Africa. If you think of coming out, you need not fear, he wrote a friend back home, for you will find as fine a spot as ever your eyes beheld. Some former slaves left the states in the wake of Nat Turner's 1831 rebellion, which prompted white Southerners to unleash a wave of violent repression throughout Virginia and neighboring states. The 1850s saw another uptick in emigration after the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and the Supreme Court decided in Dred Scott versus Sanford that descendants of slaves were not and never could be U.S. citizens. Others were manumitted by conscience-plagued owners with the condition, or strong encouragement, that they emigrate to Liberia. Robert E. Lee freed most of his slaves before the Civil War, offering to pay their travel expenses if they went to Africa. Emigration from the U.S. dropped precipitously after the start of the Civil War, although Liberia continued to accept captives rescued from illegal slave ships. Liberia, to be sure, has had its own troubled history. Despite the contract's promises of peace and friendship, settlers and local ethnic groups would clash repeatedly as the colony expanded, and as repatriates built a society that often discriminated against indigenous Africans in a way that mirrored the Jim Crow South. In 1980, long-standing resentment against Liberia's elites, most of whom were descended from freed slaves, begat a violent coup and a series of civil wars from which the country is still recovering. One of the consequences of deep societal conflict is that the past gets rewritten according to the present, Burroughs says. Conflicts are projected infinitely back. Unless you have a true understanding of the past, it's very difficult to move forward. Burroughs hopes that in some small way, the aged, fragile piece of paper he discovered might help. We're going to continue on with a little bit more geography related, little natural history in this one as well. It is entitled The Forest and the Taboo. And this one is written by... Well, let me find the author here just a moment. Here it is. This was written by Diane Machen. The Forest and the Taboo. By the time Patricia Wright and her entourage arrived at the guard station on the edge of the forest, we don't yet know where this is going, do we? About 50 local people had gathered in the shade of a blue plastic tarp in the scorching noonday sun. The station, newly constructed of cinder blocks, sat on hardened, wheat-colored earth. Scrubby grass crunched underfoot, and taller grasses nearby had no hint of green. The local cattle, called zebu, which sport a large hump, were said to be dropping dead of thirst. The punishing heat and drought were everywhere evident, but they were to be expected on this remote plateau in south-central Madagascar. So now we know this article is about Madagascar, which is an island off the southeastern coast of Africa. It wasn't the climate, though, that brought Wright here on this trip in December 2021. She had come to join people of the Bara ethnic group who live in this territory in celebrating the opening of the ranger station which she helped build, and then to journey into the wilderness. Wright, who is 77, is a renowned American anthropologist and conservationist, a professor at Stony Brook University in New York, and probably the world's leading expert on lemurs, the bright-eyed, mischievous prosimians that live in Madagascar. I think lemurs are adorable. At the ceremony, she wore a peach-colored straw hat in a shape the British monarch might favor. She was serene and erect as she listened to the speeches in Malagasy. An elder said, "Madagascar welcomes you," Wright smiled. She has been conducting field research in the island nation for more than 3 decades and has been recognized by the government with its highest honors, including a knighthood. But the Bara people tend to think of themselves as separate from the government of Madagascar. An elderly tribesman streamed Toaka Gasi, a homemade rum, onto the parched ground from a liter-sized plastic water bottle as he murmured a string of prayers. Continuing to chant and pray, he poured rum into the building's corner and emptied the bottle by vigorously splashing the crowd. The pungent yellow fluid caught the bespectacled Wright in the face. She calmly peeled off her glasses and dried them on her batik-printed scarf as she prepared to speak. "I see many friends here," Wright said, and went on to say that donors, including the research center she had founded and the Rainforest Trust, would provide a zebu and several field plows to the tribe and pay for the digging of a new well. After the ceremony, several dozen porters packed large white plastic bags with camping gear for the planned 4-day expedition. The porters were smiling, apparently happy to be working at a time jobs were scarce. They began moving up the mountain trail. From a distance, they looked like leafcutter ants with packages hoisted on their heads. Following them was Wright, her husband Noel Rao, who served as the expedition's photographer, 4 Malagasy scientists, 5 Malagasy research assistants, and 3 Bara gendarmes or local police. Each gendarme carried a Kalashnikov slung over his shoulder. Their destination was a place that Wright herself had first learned about just a few years ago, a place previously unknown to science. It's a wilderness that seems fantastic because the mere presence of many of its animals and plants defy basic ideas in biology. Also, it has been kept pristine, has been protected, partly by mythology. A taboo, actually. Perhaps that, too, contributed to the fantastic quality. In any event, Wright would acknowledge the place had a hold on her. She called it the Lost Rainforest. Madagascar, 250 miles off the coast of Mozambique, is about the size of France. It covers just 0.4% of the planet's territorial landmass, yet it contains fully 5% of its biodiversity. For every 100 plant and animal species known to science, 5 are in Madagascar. The landmass detached itself from India 80 million to 100 million years ago, so its plants and animals have had an enormously long time to evolve in geographic isolation. That has led to an extremely high rate of endemism, or unique life forms. 89% of its plant life, 95% of its reptiles, and 92% of its mammals, including more than 100 lemur species, occur nowhere else in the world. In the mid-1980s, Wright was an assistant professor at Duke University, studying tarsiers from the Philippines, when a professor challenged her with a seemingly impossible task. Find a greater bamboo lemur in the wild. The species had not been seen for more than a decade and was believed to be extinct. Wright traveled to Madagascar, ventured into the southeastern rainforest where the animal had last been sighted, and found a greater bamboo lemur. While she was at it, she also discovered a new species, the golden bamboo lemur. Wright was drawn to these charismatic primates, which most often live in matriarchal communities, demonstrate affection and keen intelligence, and are, as she allows, incomparably cute. And I can tell you from the pictures that accompany this article, they are very, very cute. The primate order is divided into 2 major suborders, which split from a common ancestor. One consists of tarsiers, apes, monkeys, and hominids. The other, lemurs and lorises. For Wright, studying what lemurs and humans have in common offers insights into the evolution and behavior of our very earliest ancestors. Soon came a pivotal moment in her research. She was sleeping in her tent near the town of Renoma Fana in 1987 when she awoke to the explosive crack of a 300-foot tree crashing to the ground. A logging company was taking down the forest. If she wanted to continue studying lemurs, among the world's most endangered mammals, she first needed to save them. So she hurried to Antananarivo, the nation's capital, to plead with the head of the Department of Water and Forests to limit or prohibit logging, thus protecting the habitat. The country had no funds for creating a park or nature reserve, the official said, but he would do what he could if she raised the money herself. She threw herself into saving the forest, setting out to win over residents of the dozens of villages in and around the lemur's forest. Some of the villages were so remote it took Wright days to walk from one to another. She asked the villagers to stop cutting trees and building houses in the forest and asked what they wanted in return. Their answer? Education, health clinics, money to grow more rice, and soccer balls. In 1989, Wright was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for her groundbreaking lemur research and conservation initiatives. She gave most of her $250,000 prize money to the villagers. She also secured a nearly $4 million U.S. aid grant to build trails, bridges, buildings, and other infrastructure in and around the forest she'd been working in. The result was Renoma Fana National Park, the nation's fourth, which opened in 1991. It covers 160 square miles of diverse forest, and its prohibition on logging and hunting protects more than 100 bird species and at least 12 lemur species, among many other things. Dozens of local residents were put to work as guides, and hotels sprang up to serve visitors. It would become one of Madagascar's most visited parks. In less than a decade, she had gone from being a junior faculty member to a global voice in primatology and conservation. On the outskirts of the reserve, she established Centro Valbio, a research campus that is an important stop for many scientists in training, including numerous Malagasy. Studies done in connection with Valbio have resulted in more than 1,000 academic publications. Pat protected a huge swath of forest and went on to build an extraordinary research center that also addresses the needs of Madagascar, says Duke University conservation biologist Stuart Pym. Those are singular achievements. This lush wilderness, classified as a humid rainforest, is situated 5,000 feet above sea level and covers more than 3,400 acres, or about four times the size of Central Park in New York City. Strangely, it was teeming with unrecognized species of frogs, chameleons, and plants. Also, there were familiar species that did not ordinarily occur together. The lemurs, the snake, and the chameleon, among other animals Wright cataloged, were in fact desert or dry forest creatures. Fascinating. It was as if they came together via some ancient crossroads, Wright says, and somehow survived. Her calling that the lost rainforest is certainly appropriate. And I wish I could describe the lemur pictures in the lemurs in the pictures a little more accurately. They have great big eyes that are gleaming, and they look a little bit like round-eared mice, but have feet like possums, little pointy noses. They just look like they're chuckling to themselves. Well, you've been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.